Greetings! Has Stonehenge been decoded? Will we be the any the wiser by the end of this programme? Let's find out. Hello there. Hope you're doing well as ever. Michael here.
Yeah, Rupert here.
And today, as promised, we're at Stonehenge, going back to Stonehenge. Always a worthy subject, but a few weeks ago, there was a new paper published by our friend, pleased to be able to call him that, Professor Tim Darville, OBE of Bournemouth University, brought out a new paper, a surprise new paper about Stonehenge, in that it dealt with the calendrical aspects of Stonehenge and the hypothesis that that's the purpose, through numerical means, what Stonehenge was all about. I say odd because in the past, you know, Tim's been more of a stone and, you know, from the archaeological point of view, you know, what's in the ground, you know, and to do with the bluestones, of course. But this sort of rather more ethereal area, it's a surprise to hear him pipe up in it.
In fairness, he has talked at length about the calendrical aspects before. It's just he's never really nailed it quite so strongly as he has in this new piece of research. As he's just,
That's right.
It seems that crossing some T's and dotting some I's has just revealed another few just refining points, don't you think?
Yes, and he's nailed it strongly enough, you know, for the mainstream media to take notice, and you know, so it has been in the headlines. So this is our two penneth worth on top of that, really. I thought I'd begin it's got a bit of a preamble at the top of the paper there. I thought I might start by reading that just to
read
sort of
that out,
give a broad context. So at the beginning, Darville says, scholars have long seen in the monumental composition of Stonehenge evidence for prehistoric time reckoning, a Neolithic calendar. Exactly how such a calendar functioned, however, remains unclear. Recent advances in understanding the phasing of Stonehenge highlight the unity of the Sarsen settings. Here, the author argues that the numerology of these Sarsen elements materializes a perpetual calendar based on a tropical year of 365.25 days. The indigenous development of such a calendar in northwestern Europe is possible, but an eastern Mediterranean origin is also considered. The adoption of a solar calendar was associated with the spread of solar cosmologies during the 3rd millennium BC and was used to regularize festivals and ceremonies. So that's it in a kind of nutshell.
That's it in a nutshell. So thanks, folks. We'll
see. Next time.
No, it is. It's truly fascinating, though, isn't it? Unraveling Stonehenge as a whole. You know, when you look at the numbers, the way he has explained them, and I confess that, you know, even though we've been, how many times have we been there? Over the years, lots, and within the stones, only a couple. But it's when somebody explains something to you the way he's gone into depth in this paper that it gives you a completely different view of what you've seen so many times. It really is quite fascinating.
It would be fascinating to get back and see, you know, if it opens our eyes a little bit more. You know, it's always viewing something in a different context.
Yes.
So we would be remiss, I think, if we didn't just remind people, you know, because it's important to remember how Stonehenge is constructed and what we're referring to when we talk about the numbers. That's a handy way of doing it. Some people will be listening audio only, though.
Folks, for those of you listening, I am just rotating in my hand a beautiful model of Stonehenge that my mother gave me quite some years ago.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Mm. It is. You do know the provenance of that?
She bought it at Stonehenge, I think.
Oh, right. Okay. From the gift shop.
Probably.
Something like, okay.
Probably, but she gave it to me about 20 years ago, I think.
Yeah. It's a funny thing, though. Even for speaking for myself, having looked at diagrams, having been there, stood in the stones several times, it's actually a very difficult structure to hold in your head as a concept, isn't it?
Yeah. I think one of the aspects of that is, you know, we've talked at length before about the Blue Stones, and of course it was all over the news before, when Mike Parker Pearson's work was talking about the relocation of an entire stone circle, whether you agree with that or not. The point is that the stones did come from Preseli. So you've got all these different phases developing the site overall. And of course, we go to it today and we see the whole thing, you know, we see however many centuries of work and we see it all there in one finished piece and imagine that it always looked like that, which of course it didn't.
Mm-hmm. So I think beginning with the outer circle, which is, I don't know, it is the most prominent thing that you see approaching it,
for
isn't
sure.
It? The
yeah.
outer circle, yes. Even though it's not as tall, that ring, as the inner horseshoe. But the outer circle is made up of 30 upright sarsens linked together with the commensurate number of lintels. Now, those are not all in place nowadays, and quite a few of them are actually missing. Either down on the ground or missing completely. So although the ring circle isn't complete now, it is firmly established through the sockets in the missing stones places that it was complete at one point.
Yeah.
I think that's all we need to say about the outer ring for the moment. The inner horseshoe, the opening end of which points to the north east.
Yeah.
And is aligned with the midsummer sunrise pretty precisely, and further on, you know, via the heelstone and some of the outer stones as well. And the back opening, you know, it being made up of sort of five groups of two making up the five trilithons that make up the horseshoe element. The rear sort of aperture, if you like, points directly southwest to the midwinter sunset.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other element that needs to be contained is outside the circle and close to the inner ring of the, or almost on the inner ring of the bank and ditch, four what are called station stones. Only two of the stones are still there, but the socket holes for the other two are there. So they're... importance with the whole thing. And something that Tim points out in this article these are the particular elements of Stonehenge that belong in phase two, i.e. they are contemporary with each other. So the fact that they come together in this, as we'll talk about numerically, makes sense. It's not the problem before with so many interpretations of Stonehenge as being a calendar or even a computer of some kind. They've brought in elements that are not contemporary, that are not contemporaneous with each other, to bring in to make something that works together. And you can't do that if they were in the landscape at different times, or, you know, were not conceived to get by the same people at the same time to be brought together. So that's what's slightly different about Tim's approach here, is that these main elements, the outer ring, the 30 stones, the five trilithons and the four station stones, they are contemporaneous with each other and so forth, conceivably work together. Have I done enough there?
Yeah. Well said, sir. Well said. It is fascinating when you look at the way the numbers actually pan out, don't you? So you've got the 30 uprights in the outer circle, which are each of the days of the month, and then the station stones. So each month was actually divided into three weeks, if you want to call them weeks, but it was each month was divided into three periods of 10 days. And the five trilithons of the inner horseshoe, they make up the five. Now, what's the word that they use? I can't remember the damn word.
Oh, a particular way, number of a particular sort of day.
Yes.
Yes.
It's the.
You can keep talking, and I could look in.
Yes,
could,
go on. You look it up. Well, so you have. So you
have continue
this,
making a fool
this
of yourself.
In a horseshoe, I memorized that word over and over and over. I said it to myself, and I still can't remember it.
Yeah.
But so they the that horseshoe of five trilithons makes up the additional month. It's like a mini month, put it that way, that gives you the extra 5 days. And then the outer rectangle of the station stones, each one of those, each year you'd move along one of those or round one of those stones that would ultimately bring you to the additional day every 4 years, the leap year. So it's an extremely complex, gloriously clever calendar on the ground.
Another way of putting it, it sounds sort of complex, but in actual, it's blindingly simple.
It's blindingly simple once it's done. But how many generations did it take?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
How many generations did it take to actually figure that out and make it sit there on the ground?
That's probably something to sort of think about when we talk about the sources of where it may have come from, whether mm-hmm. it was indigenously arrived at or whether it came from further afield.
Indeed.
But the thing to get clear is we're talking about 12 cycles of 30 to bring us to 360 days. That's... five short of the 365 that you need. So the counting the trilithons in the horseshoe, make that up, count those off. And then every 4 years, of course, you need to make up for the lost day, the 0.25. So you count off using the station stones every 4 years, and then you add another day in every 4 years, every time you complete that cycle. So it, to have those particular numbers lined up like that, that produce 365.25, it's not to be sniffed at, is it? 35 and 4. Damn. There we go. Boom, I should say. Sorry, I didn't find out the technical term that you had for the extra 5 days there.
I'll failed. Have to find it because it'll drive me insane. So you were talking about origins then?
Yes. Just before we leave those numbers, though, I think that's right. It's extraordinary that those numbers line up, if you like. So that my phrase I'm using there is that they line up. And it's not extraordinary enough in my mind. I want a bit more, because there is a missing bit, is how you tally the 12 or 6. Because the days are being tallied, but the months are not.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
I see exactly what's
keeping track of each time you do the circuit, the 30-day circuit? And ostensibly, that's missing. There is no group of 6 or 12 stones that possibly mark that off. Mm. Except that, you mentioned the 10-day week.
Yes.
Now, that does seem to be marked off in the 30 stones, because stones 11 and 21 are markedly narrower, mm-hmm. slenderer than the other uprights there, and they mark off those 10-day weeks. I'm suggesting, actually, that maybe there's a discrepancy in the 5th, 10th, 15th, 20th, and 25th to give you 6. Maybe.
Interesting. Maybe.
I don't know if Tim's looked for that, but then that would give you at least the bring you to mid. You'd only have to be counting off two groups of six then to be bringing you around.
It's also fair to say, though, and we've said this many times in other contexts as well, but the fact that we do have the missing horizontals or the missing timber or the missing, you know, whatever else was at the site, you know, we shouldn't imagine that how we see it today is how it would have appeared at the time. There might have been all sorts of refining features that are long since eroded away.
I mean, we shall have to get Tim on himself, of course, and I think we're sort of working along that progress.
He's already said he'll do it, and we'll let you know when we've managed to nail a date.
Yeah, well, if you can take any more of us wittering about Stonehenge as a calendar together with Tim himself, watch out for that. What was I going to say? Forgotten what I was going to say now.
Well, you had been talking about marking off the six.
Oh, yes, that's right. No, I said earlier off air is that because you need to be able to count things off, Stonehenge would have had to have been a dynamic site. And, you know, aside from having a special stone that you move around to mark things off, you know, what other ways could you do it? There's no obvious evidence of movable stones that are dynamic and used to tick things off, like the hands of a clock. So one can assume there would be wood, of course. The thing we're forgetting about, of course, and Tim does mention it, there's a group of unexplained post holes and stuff and sockets in the north eastern entrance, which are rather sort of random. Well, not random, actually. They look like the remains of a toll gate that was there in the entrance. You know what I mean? Sort of public access styles, you know, but more likely were to do with alignment and so on and so forth.
I wonder if they had a large stone ball that actually was rolled along the lintels.
Yeah.
So you just stop the ball at the appropriate spot every day.
Yeah. We're playing with you now. We're playing with you. However, Tim goes on to make the compelling point that yes, this calendar could have been developed indigenously, and independently in England, in Britain, 2500 BC. But there are too many similarities with calendars that were developed over in the Eastern Mediterranean, i.e. in Egypt and beyond, at the same time and slightly before. The Egyptians had something called the civil calendar, and that was structured in exactly the same way. It had this 10-day week within the 30-day month. And then, in addition, not only you had the five, you had the five deities. They were represent that those extra 5 days had the five deities: Osiris, Horus, Seth, Isis, and Nephthys. Nephthys. I'll put my teeth in.
So Tim did, raise the idea. Did the same thing apply at Stonehenge, that those five trilithons, you know, as the days were being celebrated, you know, did they relate to gods in Britain?
Here are the two main questions then. What is the likelihood that it's coincidental, the number, numerology of Stonehenge points directly at a 365.25 day? And two, how likely it is that the way that counting system is structured is identical to what they were using in Egypt around about the same time? And all those question marks of, you know, how much fluidity there was as far as travel is concerned and communication, trade, all those things, you know, which not so long ago would have been frowned upon. You know, no. Everything was developed. It was more of fashion than anything, wasn't it? In archaeology, to talk about isolation, you know, people, things developing in isolation from one another, you know, as opposed to the dispersion themes of Gordon Child, you know, where everything evolved and moved from east to west gradually. Mm. But now, because of the genetics, we've come back the other way around again to saying...
it is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because you can't dismiss the possibility. You know, as soon as you're talking about something, you know, it's like anything in science. You know, if something is based on observation and repeated observation, and it's something that happens naturally all the time, then you can't avoid the possibility that it could have arisen independently.
No, you can't.
Absolutely, it could. Equally, as you just said, you know, when we know quite how much exchange and travel was going on, that it does seem very likely. Well, it does to my mind, anyway. You know, we know that. I mean, for example, one of the things that cropped up in the news a couple of years ago was how some faience beads had been found in, I think it was Norway, wasn't it? It was certainly it was in Scandinavia. I think it was Norway. That they know came from the same foundry, for want of a better word, as the beads that were in Tutankhamun's tomb. And so you can't say that they were made by the same man. They might have been, but they certainly came from the same place. So, you know, clearly the exchanges were there. Whether they took those sorts of concepts with them, I have no problem with the concept at all. I think it's more likely than not, I think. Do you? Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And so often it is about likelihoods rather than proofs, as in prehistory, about, you know, which avenue you choose, which you seem is more likely, one solution is more likely than another, rather than being able to be absolute about it.
I have to say, you'll be thrilled that the word we were trying to remember was epigominal. Or is it on the tip of my tongue. Or is it epigominal? Or epigominal.
I do a Google search myself.
It's also referred to as the intercalary month.
Oh, that's better.
Yes. It's basically...
So it's just five days.
It is the 5 days. Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, listen, epigominal. Before we wrap up, just before, we need to touch upon, because one big aspect of it that Tim goes on to get into is the why. Why do it? Why have this enormous calendar on the Wiltshire Plain, or anywhere else for that matter? Because, of course, we can extend this idea of the numerology to other places, I'm sure. I think it is. We still monumentalize time.
We do,
in one form or another. Celebrating our relationship with time is quite a big thing. But I think fundamentally, you know, when it is a way. I think is irrelevant. I'm trying to convey to you, you know, what Tim thinks. And the idea, the first thing to dismiss, that they needed it to tell when the seasons were happening. And so farmers had to know when to plant and do the right things at the right time of year. And they said, no, that's nonsense. Farmers know perfectly well already when is the right time to do the actual work. What this is about is bringing people to celebrate at the right time, to do, in effect, the harvest festival at the right time, to have the right effect. So it's a method of communalizing things, so people can come together at the right time to do whatever it is they were doing.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? You know that you know, even I say even today. I mean, there's nothing even about it. It's it's important to humans. You know, we still celebrate New Year's Day or New Year's Eve. You know, as if you know, and that clearly is all the wonderful aspects of we're now moving back into spring and things are getting nice again. But you know, historically, exactly as you're saying, that to have a correlation, because you could be counting off months. You know, anybody could be looking at phases of the moon and saying, you know, I'll see you, you know, on the next full moon. Now, everybody would have that as a marker. But if you're actually talking about a time of the year, then it has to be related to the sun. It can't be related to the moon because there's too many, you know. If you're in Britain and you've got a lot of cloudy weather, then you can't be telling people to keep an eye on the phases of the moon because you might not see it for a month. But
Yeah. And it gives people time to prepare.
Mm.
Once you know certain things are going to happen on a certain day, you know also from the use of a calendar, you know how many days you've got.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how many weeks or what have you. Preparation would have been an important part. Travel time would have been an important part. And another aspect of it, and I don't want to really go into it here, but is the possibility of it maintaining a hierarchy, i.e. the people that have this knowledge, this esoteric knowledge about how to count off the days and know when and where the sun is going to rise and set on particular days, and to be able to command, be able to control that aspect of people's lives is something very powerful and would help to keep any elites or hierarchies, such as they may be, in place.
Absolutely. Knowledge is power. Always has been.
And on that bombshell, I think we shall wind up there. I think we've done fair justice there, if you'll forgive our waffling from time to time.
I hope we have. And anything we might have missed out, well, we'll get Tim to explain it in due course.
And as Mr. Darvill himself points out, it is a hypothesis. It is not a claim
albeit extremely compelling.
So it is something, as we've done, for all of us to contemplate and mull over and discount or celebrate, as you will. Hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you.